Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. As news breaks of the breakthrough in a possible passage of the Biden bill that partially addresses the environmental goals set forth in the Build Back Better plan that was previously torpedoed by West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin and Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema, residents in many parts of eastern Kentucky are just beginning to dig out after a record flood destroyed hundreds of homes and cars and businesses and saddled survivors with a monumental cleanup task that some are saying will take years. The flooding was the result of torrential rains that pummeled Appalachia for several days, rains that were made more severe by global warming and the effects of mountaintop removal coal mining in some cases. Mountaintop removal mining reduces the mountain peaks to rubble and leaves expansive, flat, mesa-like areas with lots of exposed rock, which are nearly incapable of absorbing or retaining water from natural rainfall. This results in disproportionate amounts of runoff, adversely affecting downstream communities. One of the hard-hit communities is the town of Whitesburg, Kentucky, home to one of the Pacifica-affiliated community radio stations, WMMT, which used to produce the Coal Report news segment that we featured here in this show. Volunteers posted photographs last week of the building that houses WMMT submerged up to the second floor in murky river water. The first floor of that building is home to an organization called Apple Shop, Apple as in Appalachia, not the fruit. Apple Shop is a grant and individual donor-supported organization dedicated to environmental justice and to preserving Appalachian culture and heritage. They've produced award-winning documentaries, and they have an extensive collection of archival recordings of folk music, storytelling, mining history, and more. It's too early to assess the losses, but at least their building is still standing. Others weren't so lucky. Many have lost their homes in their entirety, as well as their cars, and even their friends or relatives. The death toll so far is at 37. And the problem isn't just the mud and water. Runoff water from the mines tends to be toxic, and urban floodwaters are also contaminated with various petrochemical products as well as sewage. The affected communities tend to be poor, thanks in no small part to decades of abuse by the coal barons. It's ironic, therefore, that the deal struck with West Virginia's Joe Manchin apparently includes the construction of a massive natural gas pipeline that has been stalled over environmental concerns. If completed, the Mountain Valley Pipeline will carry enough gas to offset much of the gains that could be made if the latest environmental protection is passed. According to the environmental watchdog group Oil Change International, the Mountain Valley Pipeline would cause emissions of some 90 million metric tons of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases each year, not to mention the 200-foot-wide swath of deforestation around the actual pipe. The bill, however, would provide substantial subsidies for solar and wind development and would thus lessen reliance on the fossil fuels the pipeline would carry, so it may be obsolete even before investors see much of a return on the pipeline's construction. I've noticed that solar and wind company stocks have been rising sharply, far outpacing the stock value increases for oil companies, despite the oil company's record profits of late. We have a short documentary about the Mountain Valley Pipeline for you next from independent filmmaker Jack Wander. It includes interviews with property owners affected by the pipeline construction and tree sitters protesting that construction, which was halted nearly 2 years ago.
Hello, Betty.
Hey.
I'm here to help. But is it all right if I film a little bit?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to take some of these. Got a lot of hops if people at the farm want some. You have hops?
Betty, could I just get you to introduce yourself to the camera?
Okay. I'm Betty Werner, co-owner here at Four Corners Farm. Property in Franklin County, Virginia, that's being directly impacted by the Mountain Valley Pipeline.
And when did you acquire this property here?
We bought it November of 2010. And the children, grandchildren moved here December 2010. And then my husband and I, when he retired, moved here May of 2011. So we had four generations on the farm, my mother too, loving it, raising chickens and cows, milking a cow, yeah. Sitting on this porch with the absolute peace and quiet, not a house to be seen.
And all that came to an end starting?
Well, yeah, it was 2014, the fall, late fall, early winter of 2014, when word was out that MVP, this pipeline company, was acquiring land. Get a letter saying, here's an offer for the easement that we're going to put the pipeline across and, you know, take it or leave it. If you leave it, then I guess we'll have to take you to court, all that. So there was a whole bunch of folks. So this is our best pasture. One end to the other, creek to creek. And on October 24th, we were delivered four stacks of 300 pages of a lawsuit against landowners that hadn't signed. So this was less than 2 weeks after their certificate. They sued in federal court over 300 landowners in Virginia and 100 and some in West Virginia, two different courts though, West Virginia court and Virginia court, for a quick take eminent domain so they could get started. Well, obviously we lost that case. That was January of 2018, and the judge ruled in their favor, so they were here starting March, April, May, June, July. July is when they delivered all the pipes, so imagine they used our property as a thoroughfare to get to the next two parcels because they're not accessible. So imagine semi-trucks full of pipes roaring through back and forth for 2 or 3 days delivering 100 sections of pipe. That was July, and then August they were trying to get them all welded and coated, and they had to stop work, but they continued to work. But I know what that is.
What are they doing here?
Straw bale box in order to put a filter bag in when they cross creeks or pump water out. It goes in there and doesn't go off LOD. It's only like, I don't know, 3.78 or 4.78 acres actually here, but this is, I believe it's about 17 or 20 acres, the whole land here that's been compromised. Mm-hmm. The field, because this was all field, fence all the way to the creek.
And you used to have cows here?
Cows and the chickens, pigs. Hey, Fayla. Hey, girl. Pigs were in the woods here a lot, up that way.
And that was a good living.
It was, especially for the kids. This area, what's been cleared, this area was our best. Kids used to camp out here, picnic here, play in the creek here, right over under that area. We had broilers, probably 250 broilers down in the field when they were blasting in June 2018. And they were supposed to notify you, give you warning, and do all this beeps and whistles for when they were going to blast, but they didn't. They just blasted. I mean, we had their writing that said this is the procedures for blasting, which is not really called blasting. It's called forceful something fancy, a word instead of blast.
It's dynamite.
It's dynamite. Yeah, they plant dynamite all through this whole area. And of course it created a lot of dust, a lot of noise, a lot of stress on our animals.
Has someone directed you to film us? Hello?
Would you tell us what you're working on here today, sir?
Oh, they're working on the filter bag. And they have reported to FERC that this area is 100% completed with welded, coated, trenched, and I think it's like 86% backfilled.
Well, clearly not.
It's apparently not, because this has not been trenched this whole length here. And now listen, as they tear up that hill, because it's kind of a steep hill, they've gotten stuck, they've spread dirt all over. See, I did not get a solicator. Get that. So it is September 4th, 2019.
Can I ask, why you've made the decision to leave?
Just because we don't want to live here.
Even though you have so many fond memories?
I'll get very emotional. Yeah, especially the youngest grandchild, which is why I have to leave, because I pick her up from school. But she was 1.5 when they moved here, so she's 10 now, and this is all she ever remembers, is the farm growing up. So she's pretty attached. Jonas is not so much attached, because he came, he was 12, and he had to do a whole lot of work as a young preteen. A lot of work on the farm, but my father retired from the Navy and bought a farm in a homestead in Oregon, so I know what it's like to have a sustainable family farm and to work on the farm. So I was very more emotionally attached, I think, than my husband, grew up in the city. But yeah, and I know part of the reason that my husband wants me away is because I tend to get too ingrained. I just pitch a tent and live down there trying to document and show the world how shoddily they treat us, how rude and how intimidating they try to be. So it makes you kind of want to be that in return, be rebellious in return. So if all of us are fighting it, how are they going to arrest all of us? Thousands and thousands. It really becomes, I think it becomes a big blotch on the United States of America, in the world setting, where many countries have banned fracking, they've banned natural gas, they know the methane emissions and the heat. Lord, it makes you so sad about the government, federal agencies and state agencies that just kind of have folded over for the almighty dollar. That's a real sad thing. But I'd say, keep the word spreading.
If you're just tuning in, you're catching End of the Line on WRAR 97.3.
We're at ground zero. I stand just against it because it's wrong.
I will give him my offer right now.
$5.5 billion. And if you'll take that, that's not enough. They said, that'll never happen. I said, now we're all on the same page because you will never set foot on my property. This is home. You can't buy that.
This is 20 square miles of land disturbance for this project on slopes that are already called landslide prone by the U.S. Geological Survey. They could easily damage hundreds of people's water and cut it off completely and not be responsible whatsoever.
It's not this kind of benign sounding activity that they present to us. It's violence on the land.
We're going to end up with massive pollution to the to every stream that this pipeline crosses, including the cleanest waters in the state of Virginia, out in western Virginia.
It was hard to go out and look at my friends and look them in the eye, and you know, you just see what loss is there, and sorrow, and our lives just being so disruptive.
And the I'm sorry. But the people who, my friend Heidi, it was going to be within 100 feet of her home. So if it ever were to explode, her whole family would be toast. You know, if it was there, somewhere close to her home.
I'm not sure what hope is anymore. You know? I sure as hell don't want to see this happen. But do I have hope that it won't? I think what I have now is pragmatism. It's just a hunker down and do what you have to do and don't think about anything else.
Why I came here is because this is where people are fighting back. I mean, I have separate reasons for like why I'm against the pipeline, but I think the community here is very strongly against this pipeline, and that manifests itself in, you know, really tangible ways. People just showing up, people helping out however they can. They obviously want people out of here. They're trying to construct through here. You can see about how far they've come. No idea what's going to happen here or how long these trees will be up. And this is not the steepest slope that they built on. I mean, they also flipped an excavator right on the other slope, and they've done that before. So, there is some problems, I think, with using the they shouldn't put a pipeline here argument, though it is certainly true. This terrain is very, like, inaccessible and not good for a pipeline. But on the other hand, there's no land that's, like, good for a pipeline. You know, that's like, oh, this is nice and flat. Perfect, you know. Let's put a pipeline there. Especially in karst terrain, that's something else that's not... that makes this pipeline more dangerous. And then there are other risks which can't possibly be controlled for, like, climate change. I mean, no matter how they do their erosion control or whatever, there's nothing they can do to mitigate, you know, the increased risk from climate change from producing all these emissions. Because it's a natural gas pipeline. That's what it does. It was scarier when I had first gone up, obviously, because I hadn't experienced it before. But the oak especially, oaks move a lot more than, like, a pine does. But I eventually learned that's good, because that means the oak is bending and it's not going to snap or break. It has a lot more, like, flex to it. But something that I would think of when I'd be up there and, you know, the tree would be moving like this, and it'd be really loud and windy, and I would just be scared as hell, as I would think about how old my tree was. And I've been told it's somewhere around, like, 70 years old. And I'd ask myself, do you think this is the worst storm this tree has been through in 70 years? And I would think, you know, probably not. During times like that, sometimes I would put my hand out, like, through the tarp and just feel the tree and just kind of... just put my own trust in the tree and think of that and think of how old the tree is and just know, like, this tree's got me. It's going to be okay. I was there for most of the winter time, and this was the first winter I'd really been through. Well, first fall and winter I'd really been through anywhere remotely north. So I got to see snow for the first time, see the leaves change color for the first time. So that was really something.
Like, how do you stay warm up there?
I think staying warm was actually not that hard, and that was a good thing to learn. I think I learned a lot about layering, and if you layer properly, it's, you know, not too much of an issue. It'll still be cold, but, you know, when all else fails, there's always my sleeping bag within a sleeping bag, which, you know, on the really bitterly cold days, I would just retreat into that and just kind of stay there and read a book. I don't think I was really, you know, as much of a tree hugger when I went into the tree, as weird as that sounds, but being up there kind of made me more of one, and I developed a relationship with that tree, I think. I think it's a really great tree. I consider it like my tree friend, and I think that cutting down and killing that tree is in and of itself a loss. I think it's an inherent bad to kill other forms of life, especially when it's, you know, wanton and it's totally needless, as this pipeline is. And that's something that sort of goes untalked about, because, you know, even if they do cut these trees down, I think it was a win in and of itself that the trees were allowed to live for just a year longer, or however much longer, because they're their own life form, and I think they're just as worthy of life and of flourishment as we are. And, you know, for the loggers that will come and cut them down, I doubt that's something they ever think about. So imagining, you know, scaling up this much resistance to how much it's going to take to completely replace all fossil fuels, and then comparing what that, you know, what needs to happen with what's happening now with, you know, things like Extinction Rebellion and climate strike and the Sunrise Movement. I mean, no offense to those things, but I think those things are, you know, 1% of what needs to happen. It's certainly a step in the right direction, but being realistic, I have very little reason to suspect that in 11 years, we're going to replace all fossil fuel infrastructure. So given that fact, the future's probably going to be pretty bad. And that people say that's very depressing, and I think that can be true. I don't find it especially depressing. But I think there's another fact that's even worse than that, and that's the future will be extremely bad, but I think actually for some people, it's going to be okay. For the extremely wealthy, I think they'll largely be unaffected, or will even thrive. So I was arrested, I think, somewhere around July 20th or something like that, for allegedly locking myself to something in the path of the pipeline and thereby stopping construction in that area. For, it was actually about the entirety of the workday. I think they got me out around like 5 p.m. The experience was interesting, somewhat enlightening. I mean, so the police showed up. This was state police, some kind of special tactical kind of SWAT division. They didn't seem to be regular state police. And they approached me with guns drawn and, you know, said, "Show us your hands," which, you know, I was not really able to do so. And I told them from the get-go that I preferred to remain silent, that, you know, I was unarmed, you know, wasn't going to hurt them, had no way of hurting them, and I was just going to remain silent. And I said that a few other times, but in spite of that, they continued to ask me questions and seemed to get upset when I wouldn't answer their questions. And I think I got a little bit of an insight into, like, their minds and sort of what it is to be a cop. And I got the feeling that they kind of knew what they were doing was wrong, and they didn't like that I was refusing to validate them as just regular people doing a job. You know, if you talk to someone, the cashier at a gas station, you know, you might make some kind of small talk with them or something like that, because they're just a person working a job, whatever. You have no feelings for them, really positive or negative. That's not true of the police for me, and for that reason, I wasn't interested in engaging with them or validating what they do for a living, and they picked up on that and really did not seem to enjoy it and kind of punished me for that in some ways. As they were getting me out, they kind of started out, you know, feeling like, all right, whatever, we're here, we're going to do this job. And it was a strenuous and difficult task for them, And as they went on and got more and more frustrated, I felt like their mask was kind of starting to slip, and I was seeing the more violent nature of them behind that. And on a couple occasions, they said things, and I could hear, not so much in what they said, but in the tone of voice, that this is someone that's really in touch with their more violent, sort of sadistic side. And I think one of the comments was like, you know, what if we just left him here and nobody cared? And at first they were trying to be friendly and buddy-buddy, you know, you need any water, you doing okay? And then it kind of became more like that towards the end, was, you know, fuck you, like, what if we just hurt you and there's no one around to hear you scream? Because the police are people that exercise total control over other people, and they operate with impunity, and you can tell by their demeanor that they're very used to that. You know, I'm going to do whatever I want, and there's nothing you can do about it, and you're going to obey. And the slightest bit of resistance to them, in my case, just not talking to them, just bother them to no end, because they couldn't compel me to speak to them. And I think that seemed to get on their nerves. After that, I mean, the rest of the experience was just extremely boring. And I was interacting with bureaucracy, you know, filling out forms and being fingerprinted and photographed and whatnot. But I have no love for the police or what they do. And in fact, I mean, these kinds of projects could not happen without, like, implicit state subsidies and guarantees. So if there were no cops, there could be no pipeline. All of the evidence in the world says we should not be doing this. And yet they are continuing to do this. And that's, you know, mostly, I think, a result of how capitalism operates. You know, EQT has shareholders, and they are legally responsible to those shareholders and to deliver to them a maximum profit on their investment.
Like a fear,
so for them, it's just irrelevant that it might destroy human life in the next few decades. It just doesn't matter to them. What does matter is making profit in the next quarter. And that's not so much a fault of the individual shareholders, but of capitalism as a whole. And it's one of the reasons why, to me, that suggests there is no solution that is not anti-capitalist. Because the problem isn't that we just have a few bad people. The problem is that we have a bad system. And whoever is in charge is going to be beholden to that system. And so what do you say to people to kind of wake them up and, you know, shake them up and say, don't you see how wrong this all is? And I think what I would say in the most immediate term is that all of our comfort and our, you know, lush lifestyle is based on other people's suffering. And it's and also the suffering of, you know, other forms of life, which sort of goes ignored. But the entire industrial base of our civilization, like aluminum and bauxite, you know, where does it come from? Where is it being processed? And the answer increasingly is in places like India, where tribal populations that live there are being displaced, their homes are being destroyed. There's been an especially violent and military-style crackdown on people that are resisting. And that's, you know, just in one place, but that's kind of the story writ large, is these natural resources are coming from the developed world, and the circumstances in which they're being extracted are especially violent. It's also based on the exploitation of poor people and poor people of color within the United States. So if you want to, you know, people say, well, you know, things are fine now, capitalism is functioning fine now, you know, what do you say to that? And I would say, you know, well, why don't we ask someone living in, like, the slums of Cairo or in Delhi or Beijing or, you know, Los Angeles, for that matter. Ask someone living on the streets in the U.S., you know, how is capitalism going for this person? And I think once you start to think of things in that way, and you understand that something like 40% of human life on Earth doesn't have access to clean drinking water and doesn't have a stable access to food, when you frame it that way, I think it seems very clear to me that capitalism is not functioning. Or it is functioning for a small minority of people, which includes us. And it's a very sad fact that if you happen to be one of those people born in the wealthy Western world, you can actually ignore those people's suffering if you choose to and say, you know, things are fine for me, I drive this car and live in this house, I don't see a problem with capitalism. And that's because you're ignoring the billions of other people who are starving at this very minute.
Do you think it's possible to stop the pipeline?
It's definitely possible. if we want to be realistic, it's very improbable. And I personally have no problem with the knowledge that we're probably going to lose. The pipeline is probably going to be built. And that doesn't really affect me at all. I don't find that depressing or upsetting. I think that just is what it is. I personally, you know, I fight for reasons other than hope that we're going to succeed in the struggle, you know? And I think it's useful to have reasons beyond hope, because I think hope is very fickle. And I think a lot of people kind of know what it is that they should be doing, and they have some sense of how they should be living, but there's always some excuse for why they don't do that. Or they feel like they can't, or they feel like they're trapped in their job and their social life and the distractions of civilization. And, I mean, to those people, I would just say, you know, I'm here to support you in doing that thing that you should do. I don't know what you should do, but I think you do. And whatever it is, I would like to help you get there.
Some hope. There's gotta be some hope. There's gotta be some way for you to send your dogs away and to leave the land alone.
On the local front, as this program goes to air right now on WGRN on Thursday, August 4th, the Columbus Education Association, the teachers' union that represents some 4,500 Columbus teachers, is meeting downtown to vote on a strike resolution after contract negotiations with the Columbus Board of Education have abruptly stalled. Last week, as negotiations were ongoing, the Columbus Board of Education ended a meeting with the union representatives after just 60 seconds, announcing that the offer the board's lawyers presented to the union was their final offer. The lawyers then left the room. The board claims to have budgetary constraints that it must consider, and that the wages and benefits it's offering exceed the national standards, according to the board. But the wages and benefits are not the union's only concerns, or even their most urgent ones. Union representatives point to deteriorating or underdeveloped school facilities, including faulty or absent air conditioning systems, doors and windows that won't open or close properly, leaking roofs, and more, plus student-teacher ratios and class size parameters that make it difficult to teach or learn. These, the union says, are not being addressed at all. I spoke with CEA spokesperson Regina Fuentes earlier today.
Is Regina Fuentes, and I am the CEA spokesperson, and I'm also a high school English teacher in Columbus City Schools, and I've been teaching for 23 years.
And you're also a graduate of Columbus Public Schools?
I am. I graduated from Northland High School in 1994.
Columbus Alternative in 1980 for me.
Oh, okay.
So is the CEA the only union that represents Columbus teachers, or what percentage of Columbus teachers do you represent?
Yes, our logo is for Columbus teachers only. We cover about 4,500 teachers in our local unit.
When I was in high school, there were two unions representing the Columbus teachers, so now it's just the CEA.
It is just the one, yes.
Okay. So the CEA has been in this position before, at least to some extent, negotiating contracts and having those negotiations take a very long time. But what is different about this situation now?
So the normal process, this is a normal process that we go through. Our contract, our current contract ends as of 11:59 on August 21st. School is scheduled to start, at least for teachers, as of August 22nd. And, you know, like I said, this is a normal process that we go through, and we usually start negotiating months before our contract ends. The difference this time is that rather than negotiating, the district has decided to dictate to us what it is they're willing to offer and not let any other negotiations proceed past that. They have given their final offer as of July 28th, or what they're calling their final offer, and have not scheduled any other meetings past that of which to continue negotiating. And there are still many things that CEA wants to bring to the table as far as making things better for our students that they haven't even allowed us to have a conversation about.
Now, normally when one thinks of a labor dispute or a potential strike situation in contract negotiations, what comes to mind are things like working conditions, outsourcing, downsizing, grievance procedures, and of course wages and benefits. But there's more to that here. You talked about for the benefit of the Columbus students, I understand building maintenance and facilities conditions and that sort of thing are also part of the package here.
Absolutely. It's a huge part of it. You know, we have buildings that are way under code as far as working maintenance, and we have doors that don't lock. We have, you know, leaky roofs and HVAC that doesn't work in many of our buildings. And I know that the district is telling us that they're using the ESSER funds to try and alleviate those problems, and they are on a smaller scale. But if that is the case and they truly are committed to fixing these problems, then they should have no problem including that as a promissory in our contract and negotiating that with us.
ESSER funds, can you explain?
So the ESSER funds are the funds that were recently allotted due to the COVID situation and the pandemic. So they're government funds that were given to schools to try and bring their HVAC systems up to code. And I think schools all over the nation received these funds, and Columbus City is one of those school districts that received funds in order to do this. The problem is that it's just promises were made, but things are not happening.
So if maintaining and upgrading buildings to meet standard codes and just general expectations is part of the grievance, why has Columbus not affected those repairs yet, especially if funds have been available? What has prevented the Columbus Public School Board from bringing those buildings up to code?
Good question. These are the type of things that we would love to sit down and negotiate and figure out, you know, what is the holdup? Because I know that Columbus teachers have been complaining about these conditions far before COVID happened. I've been teaching for 23 years, and just in the last year, my building happened to be one of the buildings that got, you know, air conditioning installed. But in the 22 years before that, there was no air conditioning at my building. And, you know, there's still plenty of buildings out there that are in that same situation. And you can see that the climate is changing. Things are, you know, it's just not a good environment to have kids sitting in a room that's too hot, too cold.
Has enrollments increased or declined given all the development in the areas around the city outside of the Columbus School Board's purview? Has the population shifted away from the inner city schools and caused a drop in enrollment? I'm not sure.
I don't know the specifics on that. I would imagine that people, of course, consider other options as far as, you know, going to different districts or even considering virtual school. That's an option now. But I don't know all the particular numbers on that.
So real estate values in the city in most neighborhoods have been going up almost exponentially,
yes,
largely due to real estate speculation, not so much due to population growth. So in a sense, that inflation of real estate values may be artificial. But with the increased real estate values would come higher real estate taxes, and that's one of the primary ways that the schools are funded.
Absolutely.
Has the school board realized additional revenues in the last few years with which it might be able to
affect these repairs?
If they have, they're not discussing it with us. you know, these are the types of education or conversations that move education, public education, forward. These are the types of productive conversations that we should be having and negotiating with the Columbus City School Board. But they are not coming to us for those types of conversations. They'd rather be out there trying to litigate against us than negotiate.
And of course, that question was a segue to the elephant in the room, which is the tax abatements that the Columbus School Board has been giving away, including a couple fairly recently, which were significant. And then, of course, the City Council refunding money to some of the corporations that had already enjoyed tax abatements. What about the funding base for the schools in Columbus? Has the school board played a proactive role in managing the funds, the revenues that have come in, or is it just kind of riding the wave and accepting whatever money comes its way via those sorts of schemes?
I can't say confidently that the board has done a good job in managing those funds. I also can't say or speak to actually seeing any of those funds actually happening. I know that the district has kind of signed off on a lot of it and approved of some of these tax abatements that have been given out to these wealthy corporations. And we see that as a huge stab to our students because it takes money out of their pockets that should be used to make these schools better. You know, I'm happy with corporations moving into Columbus and, you know, helping to restore and bring about, you know, good things for our students. But I feel like what's being missed is the fact that our biggest investment right now should be the students of Columbus City Schools, and we are often disregarded in that whole case.
And of course, many surveys indicate that quality of education is one of the principal attractors for people in considering moving to a particular city, as opposed to a number of other factors like wages and job availability. Yeah. Quality of education tends to rank even higher on that list. And many of the jobs that are being created, especially with the new Intel plant and that sort of thing, are actually outside of the school district. Mm-hmm. So people will need places to live. They'll have to choose whether to live in a suburban district or in the city district.
Yes.
How does the quality of education and especially the building conditions and that sort of thing in Columbus compare to some of the adjacent county school districts?
As far as the educators are concerned, I feel like we have some of the best teachers in the entire state. You know, we're professionals. We have years and years of education under our belt. But we can't compete with the building conditions. When it comes to the suburban areas, they got us beat on building conditions and resources. And that is something that really needs to change if we are going to market to these individuals wanting to come and move into Columbus.
So I understand the negotiating team has met with the school board at least eight times already.
19
times over the past several months?
Well, attempted to,
yes. Okay.
Because just because a meeting is set doesn't mean that they necessarily, you know, show up and do what they're supposed to do. And we have a negotiating team of actual members. Their negotiating team is a group of lawyers that they send into the room. We never actually negotiate with board members in the room, which, you know, a lot of people might find really weird.
And then the most recent meeting was rather short, I understand.
Yes, it was 1 minute, and they just came in to tell us that that was their final offer, and they weren't going to schedule any meetings in the month of August.
I know that the school board claims that the wages and benefits package that they're offering exceeds the national standards. Is that true, or to what degree might it be true?
Well, I don't know. I won't know the specifics of whatever it is they're offering until we have our meeting this evening. And as far as anything that they put out there, they talked about benefits, they talked about wages, and they talked about a few other, you know, maybe one other thing. What they didn't talk about is what are they proposing for our students? None of the issues that they are saying is in their final offer has anything to do with the growth of our students and helping our students. And that's what we constantly come to the table with, is those things that are going to be beneficial to our students.
I think a class size or a student-teacher ratio was one of those.
Yeah, and that hasn't even been discussed. So I don't know how that could be a topic of a concern on their end when we haven't even discussed that. There's something in our old contract, our current contract, and it's nowhere near the average that they mentioned of 22 students in a class. And a lot of teachers find that very funny. And they mentioned 22 students. Like, well, where's that class?
Oh, you mean the classes are larger than 22
They're
students?
They're way larger than 22 students, yes. They can cap a kindergarten class at 27.
Wow. How much larger? I mean, would you say more than 30 or?
In high school settings, they can cap it at 36. So, and that doesn't mean like on a day like we had many of these days in the last year with COVID, where, you know, half our staff would be out sick and they still want to run school as usual, you know, at half capacity. So that means that the teachers that did show up have to cover for all of those teachers that aren't there because we can't find subs. So whatever, you know, whatever numbers you may thought you were dealing with have now doubled, tripled in some cases.
Wow. So if the membership votes tonight to support a strike resolution, that doesn't necessarily mean that a strike is imminent, correct?
Right. What tonight means is giving our, what our members will be voting on is a recommendation to our legislative assembly to send a 10-day notice of a strike to the district. That still gives them a window of time in between now and August 21st to come back to the table and negotiate. If they, you know, whether they do or don't, we will meet again on August 21st to actually vote on whether to strike as of the first day of school.
So would that give the union extra bargaining power, adding more pressure, knowing that a strike is an outcome that would be supported by a majority of members if they vote to support the resolution?
Yes. What we're looking for is the support of our members this evening, and to know that, send a message to the district that we are one body and one voice, and that we'll do whatever it takes to give our students the schools they deserve.
And have you had much support from other unions or from members of the public, from parent organizations?
Actually, yes. The you know, other teachers I know in other districts have reached out to me and very supportive. I know that our president talks to other presidents in other districts, and they've been very supportive. OEA, which is our Ohio Education Association, is actually very active in supporting us, and they're actually supporting the event that's happening this evening. So yes, I'm finding more support than on the other end. There's a lot more support happening in this situation because people realize, you know, we're in dire straits. We're in a situation here where we really need to look out for students, and it just doesn't seem to be happening on the district end.
Now, the school board had leaked some musings, let's say, about bringing to the voters a very large levy proposal.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that? Is that moving forward at that point?
Once again, the district, it didn't even talk to us, the teachers, before announcing that they're putting a levy on the ballot. And if, you know, maybe my history is incorrect, but Columbus City Schools has never been able to pass a levy without the support of teachers. So why you wouldn't include us in the conversation to announce this, I have no idea. But that's what we're dealing with.
So it seems to me that could cut both ways.
Yes,
if the union reaches an agreement with the school board that the union's happy with, then would there be some kind of an obligation then to support the levy proposal to make sure that there is funding to meet mm-hmm. those mandates that are specified? And conversely, if there is no agreement, would the public have enough confidence in the school board to award them this levy?
Yes and yes. I mean, I don't know so much about it as an obligation, but definitely we would feel a lot more comfortable and a lot more supported if the district would come back to the table and actually, you know, negotiate with us in good practice, which is, you know, we would feel a lot more supportive of supporting a levy and putting something out there, you know, to support that. But we just can't get on board right now because we are just as much in the dark as the public is.
Now, the levy that was discussed, although there was no specific proposal laid out, but it sounded like it was going to be rather large, mm-hmm. which would be very burdensome to property owners in the city, especially people on fixed incomes. Yeah. There would be no differentiation there. They'd be paying out hundreds of dollars more per year for that levy. And at the same time, the school board has supported tax abatements.
Yep.
And my understanding is that they've added a lot of administrative staff people that
yes.
are system-wide, not administrators in individual buildings.
Yes.
But what do you know about that, the administrator's
this
point
is,
of view?
This is something we've been talking about, our union has been talking about and purporting for years, the fact that the district... And here they are going to the voters once again for money that they're letting slip out of their hands on the other side with these tax abatements. You know, money that easily could be obtained from these wealthy corporations. We should not be going to the voters to ask them to pay more their fair share. It's just not right. So this is definitely something that we see as a smear on the district's face.
and the hiring of administrative staff.
Yeah, they seem to be able to find ways to hire administrator on top of administrator. They even mentioned it yesterday in their briefing, something about we're not top heavy, but, you know, when we're still missing having school nurses and counselors in our building that you promised to put in there, yet you can hire on another executive or CEO or CFO or whatever you want to call these people to do jobs that we can't explain to the general public what they're doing. It seems very non-transparent and you know, very adverse to our cause and what we're trying to do.
Can you foresee a situation in which the union is able to reach an amicable agreement with the school board, thereby averting a strike, allowing teachers to go back to work, and some of the changes that you've been trying to bargain for are realized, or at least there's the appearance of a good faith effort, and yet, based on the principles that you just explained with regard to the tax levy,
yeah.
the tax levy comes around and the public won't vote for it for those same reasons?
We're hopeful that we can reach an agreement before school starts. You know, that is the goal. We don't want to strike. However, if the district continues their stance of not wanting to come back to the table and being stubborn about any type of negotiating whatsoever, you know, that's going to cause problems down the line. And I cannot see the public having faith in supporting a levy that doesn't have the backing of their teachers.
So even if there's an amicable agreement, but it takes a while and mm-hmm. the school board drags their feet, I mean, it's possible, isn't it, that there could be an agreement to extend negotiations into the beginning of the school year by
yes.
extending the previous year's contract. Would that be an acceptable compromise?
I don't think that's what our goal is. Our goal is to get a fair contract established. We're not willing to go into a new school year without a contract. So that's why striking is on the table, unfortunately. But it is something that we'll have to do if this language continues.
Now, if there is a strike, and of course schools won't be able to operate for the duration, I mean, there aren't enough people to substitute for the striking teachers, there aren't enough staff people. What about support staff, custodians, and that sort of thing that might be represented by other unions? Do you think that they would join in solidarity?
I think they will join us to the extent that they are allowed to in solidarity. We don't expect them to do anything that jeopardizes their own contract. Like OPSI is the, you know, they're the custodians, the security, the TAs. They're all of the other parts, and they have been very supportive with us when they can. And we're supportive of them as well, and we understand that they stand in solidarity with us, but we also understand that they can't. They're going to have to do their job, and they're going to have to go in and do their jobs in the event of a strike.
The school board elections aren't up yet, but they do occur cyclically. Are there people from within your ranks that might be aspiring for candidacy?
Not that I've heard, but I'll definitely keep an eye on that.
And if there is an amicable agreement reached and some kind of good faith effort is made, even if it's incomplete, to address some of the concerns that would become contractual obligations, what else might the school board do to repair relations with the community and with the teachers?
Be genuine about the, you know, the proposals and the ideas that you have committed to, you know. Don't say one thing and do another. We need transparency to our community. Our students deserve your transparency, and our students deserve to show up to safe, well-maintained, fully resourced schools. I mean, it's just the bottom line. There's nothing to be gained out of not being truthful to your word.
Is there a mechanism for that kind of communication? I mean, is there a liaisonship between the school board and the union normally throughout the year for when they do have policy proposals and that sort of thing?
I'm not exactly sure on how all that breaks down. I'm sure there is. And it's definitely something that's going to have to be looked at, you know.
I'm thinking something like an ongoing joint commission with representatives from both bodies.
Yes.
Where these things can be brought up.
Yes. And I know that our association does whatever it can to constantly be in amicable communications with the district. We are not the enemy. They're not the enemy. We want to negotiate. We want to get this resolved because at the bottom line, you know, our kids, our students, are the ones who are going to benefit from this or be hurt from this. And we have to look at that and take this very, very seriously.
I plan to attend the CEA membership meeting this evening on Thursday, August 4th, and we'll have more to report on this issue next week or perhaps tomorrow in this same program on WCRS-FM. This is Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRS-FM 92.7 and 98.3, and WGRN-LP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care.
Distant corners, when someone needs to learn, you'll find the teacher changing lives as pages turn. Stand together, united we are one. Stand together, together we belong. Proud to be union, standing strong. No matter where you come from, no matter how rich or poor, all our dreams are equal. The future could be yours.
program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.